All over the country,
we need to improve reading in Wisconsin.
Schools are changing the way they teach reading.
I'm calling for a renewed focus on literacy.
We have gotten this wrong in New York and all across the nation.
And it's happening because of a podcast.
I think your podcast has changed my life.
And I'm going to share this podcast with everyone I meet.
Sold a Story investigates how teaching kids to read went wrong. New episodes of Sold a Story are available now.
Good morning, I'm Angela Davis. Today, a broadcast of a conversation I hosted yesterday about the impact and the legacy of George Floyd, a black man killed by a white Minneapolis police officer on Memorial Day in 2020. George Floyd's murder in Minneapolis sparked calls for racial justice around the world. His memory is being kept alive through memorial sites, artwork, and other creative expression, proposed policy changes, and community aid work. But 1 year later, Minnesota continues to grapple with questions about police reform, racial inequity, and the meaning of the word justice. Why is it important to carry this history with us, and how does the past inform our work toward a more equitable future? My guests were Janelle Austin, the lead caretaker at the George Floyd Memorial at 38th and Chicago in Minneapolis; Harry Culbert Jr., the editor-in-chief of North News, a community newspaper in North Minneapolis; and Tina Burnside, a co-founder of the Minneapolis African American Heritage Museum and Gallery. Before we talk about the work that each of you are doing, I do want to ask you a personal question. How did the murder of George Floyd affect you? You know, as you reflect on the past year, do you think that it has changed you in some way? Because I've talked on my talk show quite a bit about how I feel different. It has changed me. So I like to know how other people are feeling about this. Harry?
Absolutely. And it's weird because as a journalist, I get to kind of lose myself in the work when we're talking about the murder of George Floyd. But it's moments like this where I reflect as a black man and it hits me and hits hard in terms of what really happened, what I really witnessed over those 8 minutes and 46 seconds captured on video, what we now know is 9 minutes and 23 seconds. And it hit me differently because I'm from St. Louis, Missouri. So when Mike Brown was killed in August of 2014, that I had a personal connection to that because that was home. When Freddie Gray was killed in 2015 with the Rough Ride, I was, as a youth, a college student, arrested for being at the wrong place at the wrong time and experienced one of those rough rides. So again, that had a personal connection and it hit me. What with George Floyd, the other killings we heard about, we saw the aftermath of, for instance, with Philando Castile, we saw what happened after. With George Floyd, we watched a man die. And I personally, up until the trial, had only watched the video once because that's all my soul could take. I didn't need to see a man die. And in that fashion, in that cold, callous fashion of looking at Derek Chauvin's face and knowing he didn't care that he was killing a black man, and he didn't care that that life was precious. And so it's affected me greatly. It's still difficult to think about 1 year later.
Tina, how do you describe how you have been affected by the last year, the murder of George Floyd and witnessing the response to it?
I would agree with what Harry said. It was disturbing on so many levels. It was disturbing because we hadn't seen something like that before. Like he said before, we had seen the aftermath, or the other killings had been shootings. This was where the officer kneeled on George Floyd's neck. And like Harry said, we watched him die and we watched him take his last breath. And that was just disturbing. And what was really disturbing, I had watched the video, but I couldn't watch it anymore when it got to the part where George Floyd cried out for his mother, because that was just painful, because everybody knows that when you are in pain, when you are in distress, when you have nowhere else to turn, you cry for your mother. And that just really, you know, touched my soul. I think it touched everyone's soul. And so it was just very, very disturbing. And then also, George Floyd was killed in the neighborhood where I grew up. I grew up on the south side of Minneapolis, just blocks away from 38th in Chicago, which is now George Floyd Square. And so that was also disturbing to see that happen in my neighborhood. And so it was just, you know, very traumatic. And then with the trial, to see the video played over and over again, that was just, you know, traumatizing for me and I'm sure for, you know, everyone in the Black community. And so it's just been very difficult to deal with.
And Janelle, have you even had time to reflect on this and just personally how, you know, you've been affected? Because as the lead caretaker of the memorial, you've been there on site nearly every day for the last year.
Yeah, it changed my life completely. I was in Austin, Texas when George Floyd was murdered. Like Miss Tina, I grew up in that neighborhood, and my family home is still here, just a couple blocks away. And my family asked me to return home because the work that I do is racial justice work. And at first I said no. And then they urged. And so I did. I came home and I said yes. So I literally relocated my entire life to be present in and with my family and for my family and my community. And there was something about the murder of George Floyd, the lynching of George Floyd, that brought these neighborhoods together, because people who are not from there do not understand that there are four neighborhoods at that intersection, one on every corner. And so when you're dealing with different communication streamlines, there are also two different city council members and two different state senators. And so there is a lot to keep neighbors siloed from different communication channels. But there was something about the uprising. And so today is the 1 year anniversary when the people stood up and said, not in my backyard. And that, like, I remember there was grills and mutual aid and like dancing and art and people publicly grieving, people praying, people holding space with one another. There were circles, like, the way in which the community came together to hold each other in our collective and public grief was extremely powerful. And I think that being able to be in that kind of community and find a place through serving the community with caretaking, it has profoundly changed my life. Now I kind of live by the two guidelines of caretaking, which I now consider kind of like life vows. One, everything is somebody's offering, therefore nothing is thrown away. And two, that the people are more sacred than the memorial itself. And what does it look like for me to live my life in such a way where we're not throwing people away? Because now I'm embedded in a community that is committed to not throwing people away. George Floyd's death changed my life.
Now, all three of you, in different ways, are documenting what happened at 38th in Chicago last May. You're gathering stories, you're collecting artifacts as part of this collective memory of the murder of George Floyd and the impact it had on all of us. So I want to know, how do you describe, like, why is it so important that we don't ever forget about this? Because it's human nature to want to suppress, you know, bad memories and, like, not think about things that hurt us. But why is this different, Tina?
Well, I think what's important and the reason why it's important to document it, and what we did at the museum was we started documenting right away, and we started to get involved right away. And we were closed at the time when George Floyd was murdered because of COVID, we were closed. Mm-hmm. And so we didn't want to sit around and wait until, you know, a year later to start addressing what was going on in the community with the uprising that was sparked by the murder of George Floyd. And so what we did right away in like July, we did a Black Lives Matter mural on Plymouth Avenue in front of the museum over north to bring the community together and to also show the museum solidarity in standing with the community in the fight for racial justice. And so we got 16 artists together and curated the Black Lives Matter mural. Each artist did their own individual letter. And so that was like the first thing that we did to be involved in the movement. And then also when we opened then in August, we did an exhibit called Gathering His Name from Protest to Healing for George Floyd. And that was a portrait photography exhibit by a photographer, John Stein, who went out in the community and he took photographs of people at protest and up at George Floyd Square and individuals who were participating in either providing food for the community, people that were protesting, people that were making art. And his photographs were different than like some of the photographs that the media were using, because the media always focused on like the burning buildings or focused on property damage, but they didn't focus on the people who were getting involved, the people who were moved to, you know, come out of their houses during the pandemic and protest in the streets and try and help other people and to raise their voices. And so he took pictures, black and white photographs of people, and also did like short interviews about why were they there. And so we have that currently still up in the museum. We put that up in August when we reopened, and it's still up now. And I think that that's very important because too much focus is on property damage and not enough focus is on people. And so we did that exhibit. And then we're also participating with a collaboration with the Minnesota Historical Society and Hallie Q. Brown Community Center over in St. Paul, where the museum is participating in the History Is Now. And that's where we're collecting stories from the community about how were they affected by the murder of George Floyd and how has that changed their life? How has that changed their perspective on policing in the Twin Cities? And so we're a part of that. And then one thing that the museum did was we are doing an oral history project that's part of that History Is Now. And so our community engagement specialist, Alexis Camille, she's gone out into the community and she's working with the elders from Sabathany and at Martin Luther King Park. And she has done Zoom calls with them. And she's also done videos with them out in the park to get their responses to, you know, how did the murder of George Floyd affect them? And how have they been affected by racism, systemic racism throughout their lives? And so that's an oral history project that we're working on right now. And so we just felt that it was really important to document what was going on because history was unfolding right in front of our eyes. And mm-hmm. so it's very important to preserve that history because otherwise, like you said, people's memories are very fleeting and people are very fickle and they will, you know, immediately forget about this, you know, a couple weeks later, a couple months later and move on to the next thing that's, you know, in the news or whatever they feel is important or go back to their daily lives now with, you know, things opening up. And so we can't let forget about what happened. We can't just, you know, push this to the side and move back. And I hear a lot of people say, oh, we can't wait until we get back to normal. Well, it's never been normal for the Black community. And we don't want to go back to what some people consider normal. We want to have this conversation about systemic racism. We want to have a conversation about racial disparities in policing, in housing, in education, in employment. And we want to talk about solutions. And so we need to have hard conversations and not just, you know, go back to quote unquote normal.
And Harry, as a Black journalist, you have written many stories in the past year. One that really stood out to me that was published just a few days after George Floyd was killed. You did a Q&A where you interviewed yourself. Tell me about that piece and why you chose to do that.
I was wrestling within myself as to how my job is to be a journalist. My purpose in life is to be a Black man in America. And I was having this internal conflict of going out, covering the stories, asking the questions, the kind of robotic portion of the job. Hey, the who, what, when, where, and why. And then realizing that as a Black person, this was me. I was covering myself. I was seeing myself in this death. And I was recognizing that this wasn't the first time that I was seeing it. I saw it with Philando Castile, who was pulled over some 50 some odd times. And I reflected on the fact that I've been pulled over 20 some odd times, once for driving too slow, to show you the magnitude of the disparities that we're talking about. When I remember going to the funeral of Philando Castile, and so I decided that the best way to tell this story was to just give my internal conflict and put it out to the world. Going back to your question about documenting and why we don't ever forget, remember when America was terrorized on September 11th of 2001, the mantra was never forget, because we never wanted to forget the horrors that we experienced on that day. On May 25th, 2020, we don't ever want anyone to forget the horrors that Black America experienced on that day. And that's why it's so important that we tell the story. And I realize a lot of times when I'm doing a story, oftentimes I go back to old periodicals, sometimes quote unquote lesser known periodicals in the Black press, the Pittsburgh Courier or things of that nature, to find the stories that I won't find in mainstream media. And I realized my job as a journalist is to tell the story in the now, but to preserve it for the future.
And Harry, I pulled an excerpt from that piece again that was published on June 1st of 2020. You wrote, "I will never forget being up until 5 a.m. 2 days in a row these past 2 days, one guarding a cluster of businesses, the other simply guarding my home. Each night I'm hearing gunshots going off, lots of them. And you're trying to pinpoint the location. You see these cars with no plates cruising the avenues, and you're on edge. I have to try and nap during the day so I can be awake during the night. I used to love the night. Now I hate it. I fear it."
That will never... One, my sleep pattern is still off to this day because of that. But when we go back, that's one of the things that a lot of people don't talk about, is the terror that we as residents were under during that time, when you had the governor, the director of public safety, mayors of Minneapolis and St. Paul saying, hey, there are white supremacists within our midst and they're here to do us harm. And then you're on all of these neighborhood groups talking about, hey, we found gas cans in our back alley, things of that nature. And the neighborhood corner store, this is the part that I'll never, like, it's etched in my memory. I wake up on Friday morning. Thursday night is one of the biggest nights of the unrest. I wake up on Friday morning and I have an app called Citizen, and the app says, the store at Penn and Dowling is engulfed in flames. And this is like at 6 a.m. I get up and my girlfriend, Devonda, she goes on a Victory Neighborhood page, which is a Facebook group. And she said, and there are people live streaming it. And she had been stoic throughout this entire time. That was the first time I saw her break down in tears, and it broke me down. And I realized how real this situation was for us.
Janelle, as the elite caretaker there at the memorial, you're not just, you know, preserving items. You're in constant conversation with people. And so when you think about the work you're doing and preserving these items, the flowers, the artwork, why is it so important that we don't forget and that we remember in great detail what we've been through in the last year?
You know, one of our Black art elders in the Twin Cities area, Miss Esther, she installed enamel on steel image of a Sankofa bird on the wall of cooked foods just behind the memorial, with the help of the Pillsbury House and Theater and Chicago Fire Arts Center. And the Sankofa bird is an image where the feet are facing forward and the head is looking back. And it comes from the West African tradition that many of us in the African American tradition has adopted, which basically means we have to look back in order to understand where we are going and how to move forward. And I think what Ms. Tina said, it was so important in that if we don't remember, we will forget and move on like with business as usual and act as if nothing ever happened. And so to be able to allow people to recall the offerings that were laid at the memorial and come to George Floyd Square and see the images still there, see, I like to call them creative expressions of pain and hope. It forces us collectively to remember how we felt, forces us to remember how we process the grief. It forces us to remember that a man was lynched on this corner. And I think that in that remembering, we're then able to commission ourselves to actually continue in the work of racial justice, because that memory is going to set the trajectory for how we actually get justice done. Because we have a framework for injustice. We have a framework for what we don't want to happen again. And so memory is key and is important. It's important for us to remember how we felt. And I think we're able to navigate the release of the trauma through health and wellness healing, but also still maintain a kind of memory that will help us move forward in healthy ways. But that takes work and that takes time. But it's powerful. What the people have done collectively, and then the work of the community at 38th in Chicago to caretake for what the people have offered in their protest, collectively, it's powerful. And I think it has the power to heal us. I think it has the power to commission us to continue the work of racial justice.
It is clearly a healing space. I've heard that. I've experienced that in my own visits. But, we've seen attacks at the memorial site where people have shown up to deface property. I mean, most recently, surveillance video showed a man, arrive in a truck and start tearing things down, goes back to the truck, brings out an axe and starts chopping things down. We've seen, a man come out and spray paint the huge mural of George Floyd's face. What do you make of that? How have you handled that? For me, I see it as that, well, we got a lot of work to do still, clearly.
Absolutely. People be doing the most. I don't know how else to say. Like, that is like mental wellness instability. Like when you go for an axe to start chopping down a hut. Or in the case of the young man who spray painted the mural, we actually went through a restorative justice process with him.
Tell me about that. So this was a young white man who spray painted mm-hmm. that was several months ago. What does that mean? You went through a restorative process with him. What does that mean?
So we actually worked with a local neighborhood restorative justice organization to actually be in dialogue to figure out, well, what would justice look like in this scenario? And how do you repair the harm done? Part of that process, we actually asked him to participate in caretaking work. So if you were going to see yourself defacing murals, we actually need you to come and actually restore and give life to the community and do something positive with the work. And I will never forget the first day he came to, we were doing indoor conservation. And I brought in some pieces from the memorial. I hadn't looked at them. I literally took the first one off, or I did the first one on the stack. And I said, well, this is how you do the inventory. And then I said, okay, you're doing the second one. We took the first one off the second one. And I said, okay, the thing with the offerings is when we do conservation work, it's important for us to spend time with the pieces and to feel the piece before we actually start documenting what's there. And so tell me about the piece. Talk it out loud. I want to hear you say it. And he was, the piece had said something like it had something to do with blackness and divinity. I can't remember the exact words, but I remember like his face just started turning red. And it was extremely powerful because it's like, yeah, when you chose to deface the image of George Floyd, you chose to deface the divinity of the image of blackness, of black people. And you got to wrestle with that because somebody wrote that on a sign, on a protest sign that now you're caring for instead of defacing. And so not only is his time and labor actually helps us continue in our work, but engaging the pieces helps his healing process as an offender to say, how do we restore the community to wellness together, including him?
When you hear about that, Tina, did you hear some of the reports of property being defaced, destroyed at the memorial site? What did you think of when you heard that, Tina?
There's a lot of work that needs to be done. And one of the things that kind of struck me when George Floyd was murdered, and a lot of people in Minnesota were saying, oh, that's not us. That's not us. How could that happen here? Because Minnesota has always had that image of being a very progressive state and a very liberal state. And so people were in denial about, oh, that couldn't happen here. And I think that that's one thing where we talk about, you know, where history comes into play. That if people really knew history, and if the history of not just white people were taught in the schools, then they would know that there is a dark past to Minnesota history. Mm-hmm. And one of the things that we did at the museum last year was we had up an exhibit of the lynchings in Duluth that happened in 1920, because it was the 100th year anniversary of that. And so we felt it was important to commemorate that. And then also we had that exhibit up, plus we had the exhibits about George Floyd and the murder of George Floyd. And so it kind of put that into context that, look, 100 years ago, three Black men were lynched in Duluth, Minnesota, because they were, you know, accused of raping a white woman, which was a lie. And then the police knew it was a lie, but they let a lynch mob come in and drag these three men from the jail
with
and lynch
thousands
them.
Of spectators.
Yeah, with thousands of spectators who stood there then and took pictures next to the bodies and distributed them as postcards. And then you fast forward 100 years later to, like Janelle said, the public lynching of George Floyd. And so people need to know that history. And then I think they wouldn't say, oh, that's not us. And oh, that couldn't happen here. And so I think history is very important because it puts things into context. It educates people. And also when you know history, I think it breaks down barriers, because a lot of times people act out of fear because of the unknown, or they think people are different. But if you know someone else's history, if you know their perspective, you kind of see we all kind of have like we have common needs, or we have, you know, common wants and desires. And so that breaks down barriers, but you've got to learn about other people's history, and you've got to have respect for other people's history and what they've gone through to really be able to understand and to empathize.
I want to take some questions from the audience, but Harry, I want to give you an opportunity to respond to the question. We were talking about attacks that we have seen to property there at the George Floyd Memorial. And just, you know, when you read about or heard about or maybe wrote about it, like, what were you thinking that someone would go out and deface a mural with George Floyd's face?
Racism is a hell of a drug. The only way that we can get past this is if we start to redirect the way in which people think about ethnicity. I don't even like to call it race. I'm a human. I'm a Black man, and I'm a proud Black man, but my race is human. And I think that, and even in that small shift in language, people can start to understand that there's a oneness amongst us rather than the divisions amongst us.
All right, let's bring in some questions from our audience. Dana writes this: do you think we should have an annual George Floyd Day or have his murder put into Minnesota school curriculum? What can we do so that lessons from George Floyd's murder are not lost. And Harry, you're nodding, so I'll go to you first. Does this need to go into the school curriculum? And then what? Like, what do you put in the curriculum? Who chooses it?
Those questions I don't have necessarily formulated in my head, but I know the direct answer is absolutely, we need to have a George Floyd Day. But here's where I wrestle with. I specifically didn't go to the memorial yesterday because I didn't want to memorialize his death. And that day symbolizes his day of death. And so I don't necessarily want it to be on May 25th every year. With the same breath, I also say we will never forget May 25th of 2020. But it just didn't feel right for instance, when we recognize the Reverend Dr. Martin Luther King, we recognize his birthday in January. So I don't want to constantly remember the date of his brutal killing.
Janelle, your thoughts about Minnesota school curriculum and adding, you know, updating the history curriculum, or I mean, is it social studies for middle school students? What are your thoughts on that?
Yeah, absolutely. I think the first two thoughts that came in my head was like, sure, but white people can't write it and neither can the government. Like those were both my first two thoughts. It has to be Black centered voices. I would love to bring in some Black historians to also tie the other stories of the other deaths in Minnesota as well, and even around the country, because I think the reason why the uprising happened was because George Floyd was not the first, right? I think people were sick and tired of being sick and tired. And then also the layer of COVID. So that has to be tied in as well, like the context of what brought people together. I think that it's important that the government doesn't write it because the state killed George Floyd. It was a city employee on city time that murdered George Floyd. And they lost privileges of writing the story when that happened. And so I really think those voices have to be uplifted from the community, by the community, and be told in the perspective of the people. And so, yeah, I would love for whoever Black historians exist out there who wants to take on that work or who feels called to do that work, to answer that call, because we do need that in our curriculum.
What about a George Floyd Day? And Harry brought up the point, maybe it's not May 25th. Is that, should this be an annual day of reflection?
So I will say this, when the George Floyd Global Memorial put on the celebration yesterday, we had discussed and had listened to several community members about what was needed. And people were like, we want a celebration. Like we need something to lift up our spirits. And we had talked about, do we do Memorial Day? Do we do the 25th? And Miss Angela Harrelson, George Floyd's aunt, she was like, I want it on the day. And so we're like, okay, we're going to do it on the day. And I think what I witnessed was when we invited all of the families who also were victims of injustice and loss. And we had honored seating for them because of what they've gone through. And one of the relatives of Jacob Blake came up to me afterwards, and I could see his tears. And he was just saying, thank you. He said, I needed something that would bring me the joy, right? And because it's heavy. It's heavy work fighting for justice. And so I do think there should be a kind of day, whether or not it should be called George Floyd Day or whatnot. I think we should think about that critically because there are so many families in Minnesota that have suffered these losses. But I do think we need a kind of marker of remembrance that also brings joy into the work of fighting for justice.
And if you don't mind, if I jump in very quickly, okay, on what was being said, as a journalist, I've covered the killings of Jamar Clark, Philando Castile, George Floyd, and most recently, Dante Wright. I've been to three of their funerals. Because of COVID, within the past year, I've only worn a suit twice. And that was to the funeral of George Floyd and then the funeral of Dante Wright. So to Janelle's point, I don't want us to, George Floyd was the culmination of, he was the, what we thought was saying no more. I say what we thought because while Derek Chauvin's on trial, we have Dante Wright. But all there are so many names, way too many names, that we should be remembering them collectively.
And Tina, I want to give you an opportunity to respond to this audience member's question. Dana wrote, do you think we should have an annual George Floyd Day or have his murder put into Minnesota school curriculum?
I definitely think it needs to be put into school curriculum, along with lots of other Black history that is not included in school curriculum. And that's a really important thing because history, as it's told in America, is always told from a white perspective and with white narratives. And I think that needs to change because America is made up of all different people of different backgrounds, different races who all contributed to the making of this country. But the only stories that get told are the stories of white people. And so I think definitely the history curriculum in Minnesota schools needs to change, and it needs to be more inclusive of not just Black people's story and history, but also everyone else's stories and history. And I think that's really important because one thing we used to do tours at the museum before COVID, and a lot of times people would bring like from their classes from Minneapolis Public Schools or other school districts to the museum because they weren't getting Black history in schools. And they would say, oh, we never heard about this, or we never knew about this person, or we never knew about this event. And that just shows how the curriculum is lacking. So I think that that's very important that the history curriculum be rewritten to be more inclusive.
I want to bring in another question from an audience member. This comes from Joey. Joey asks, what else can be added to the George Floyd Policing Act that would make policing feel safer for the Black community? And this is somewhat related to a question that someone also wrote when they registered for the event. I want to know more about how to reimagine policing and community safety and support. And Tina, in addition to your work at the museum, you're also a civil rights attorney. Do you have any thoughts or what have you been thinking about that would be valuable in terms of reimagining policing and all of these conversations about police reform on a federal and state and local level?
Yeah, I think when you talk about reimagining or reforming police and how policing is done in this country. One thing I think people have to realize is the history of how the American police force came about, that it developed from slave patrols. And so it has that history already of having a racial bias in it. Also, I think that, and I know some people don't agree with this, but I think that there should be a residency requirement because I think when you do not live in the city, that you are there to work in or to protect and serve, then you don't really have anything invested in that community. And so you just come into the community, you police people, you terrorize people, and then you go back out to the suburbs or to a rural area. And so I think it's really important for people to have an investment in the city. And you do that when you live in the city, when you get to know the people, when you care about the city. Also, there's been the conversation about police are not equipped to handle every response that people may call the police for. And so that gets into the responses for mental health calls. Police are not trained to go out and address mental health issues or when people are in the midst of a mental health crisis or episode. And so there needs to be a component where there are mental health, trained mental health professionals, social workers, and not everything needs to be addressed by the police. Janelle had mentioned restorative justice. Mm-hmm. Sometimes those are different ways that you can deal with things that may been before in the past police calls. Or there's also mediation that you can do, community mediations. And so there's different things if you get creative to think about, you know, ways that the police force can evolve and change.
And Harry, in your conversations with folks in Minneapolis, what are they saying about police reform and what, you know, what are some tangible things that can happen right now?
So in North Minneapolis, what we're seeing is the conversation is kind of being juxtaposed because we are having this spat of horrific violence. We've lost a beautiful young girl of just 6 years old last week. We have two other young kids who are fighting for their lives due to violence perpetrated on the community. And so a lot of residents are saying, well, it's because of this defund the police talk. I don't necessarily think those who are out perpetrating these crimes are thinking that much about the nuts and bolts of defund the police. And once again, I'm a journalist. I deal in words. A lot of times, if we just change certain words, people have better understanding. When you're talking about defunding the police, defund does not mean disband. And I think that's where a lot of people got confused in all of that. They were like, well, you want to get rid of the police? And it's like, no, we want to get rid of extra weaponry that they're using upon the community and things of that nature. As a Black person in whether it's Minnesota or whether it's St. Louis, Chicago or wherever, when we walk out of our streets, especially if we live in an urban inner city setting, we are the most likely to be the victim of crime. And we're most likely to be the victim of police abuse. And that's a heavy burden to deal with it because you're getting pressure from both sides. You're constantly on a swivel. And it becomes exhausting, to be honest, when you have to deal with that pressure of just leaving your house. I agree with Tina. Residency requirements, huge. It's really hard to kill Dante Wright if you know who Dante is. It's really hard for you to even want to arrest him for something so minor that you say, hey, look, Dante, I know you got this going on. Go get this taken care of. I don't want to have to deal with it again. It's a conversation. It's not a taser that then becomes a 9mm.
And Harry, how are you processing what we're seeing with the community violence and you know, and Black on Black crime and so many of the young people and people with guns? I mean, is this all going back to educational experiences? Is it tied to what is going on?
That's a good question as to what is going on, but it's noticeable. I live in North Minneapolis. Unfortunately, I was one of the 911 callers when the shots rang out that killed Young Anaya because we were outside just trying to enjoy the day when the shots rang out. It's something that needs an all hands on approach. This is something that the police can't solve for us. This is something the community actually has to solve. One of the things that I loved about the community coming together on May 19th, which was the day that Anaya passed, they gathered at 36th and Penn. And what I saw was what can happen when we reimagine what community is. The people of the community shut down the block. The government didn't shut it down. The city didn't shut it down. The people of the community shut down the block. But they did it in a manner in which respected the community. For instance, buses were trying to get down Penn Avenue. They would reopen the block to bring the buses through. That right there lets us know that we have the resources within to address many of the problems that we face within the community. They didn't it wasn't some organized plan. They got together. They said, this is what we need. You're here. You're here. You're here. We mobilized and they got it done.
And Angela, could I just follow up on one thing? I did just want to say that I don't think it should be characterized as Black on Black crime because it's just crime, because crime happens in close proximity to, you know, mm-hmm. two people. And so, you know, when crime happens to white people where both the individuals are white, the victim and the perpetrator, nobody says white on white crime. And so, you know, I'd like for people just to, you know, acknowledge it as crime and not black on black crime. And then also, a lot of times people will try and not to get away from addressing the issue of police killing black people. They'll say, oh, well, black people are killing, you know, each other. But crime and police, police sponsored crime, I guess I would call it, or police killing black people and individuals killing each other are two totally different issues. And people sometimes want to conflate the two so that they can deflect the conversation away from police killing citizens. And so I just want to, you know, caution our audience that they're two different things.
Mm-hmm. Thank you, Tina. Janelle, I wanted to make sure we gave you an opportunity to, you know, share what your thoughts and also your conversations you're having with people about police reform or what would make things better? What would make Black community members feel better about their relationship with the police?
Yeah, I mean, that's like four police officers were involved in the murder of George Floyd. That's trauma. And I don't think one can look at a police uniform and not be triggered by that trauma. I think that we need to reimagine how we do public safety altogether. I think we as community need to stop outsourcing the responsibility of being a community to the police. I think that community is the antidote to racism. Because as we start leaning in to actually love one another and support one another and know each other's names, it starts to hold us accountable to actually deal with the anti-Blackness that lives within us, and to start thinking of how we do the systems differently so that way everybody can have an equitable chance at thriving. So yeah, I with the police, It's a system that can't be reformed. I think we need to start over. I think, yes, we have laws and we're a nation of laws, as folks like to say, but, and so therefore they would say we need law enforcement, but it does not have to look like policing. That is just what started so many years ago, and then they've continued the tradition because institutions are hard to change. So I think we need to reimagine a world beyond policing and still find safety through justice. The more people have what they need for holistic of well-being in life, the less harm that they'll cause for each other, toward each other. So what does it look like to have a public safety plan that is rooted and holistic justice for everybody?
You've been listening to a broadcast of NPR's latest In Focus conversation. My guests were Janelle Austin, the lead caretaker of the George Floyd Memorial at 38th and Chicago in Minneapolis; Harry Colbert Jr., the editor-in-chief of North News, that's a community newspaper in North Minneapolis; and Tina Burnside, a co-founder of the Minnesota African American Heritage Museum and Gallery. This and other conversations about racial disparities continue in our In Focus Facebook group. I also want you to save the date for our next virtual discussion, our next In Focus event. It's a conversation taking place on June 30th, and it's about environmental sustainability in Greater Minnesota. This conversation was produced by Rachel Young and Gregory Smith. Thanks again for joining us today. Be safe.